Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
We're back. Another toy department. Derek Madden, Matt Kolsky. I feel like we should check in on Kolsky in the heart of Sadland right now. Are people still sad in Sadland, or have they gotten over it over there in the Bay Area?
It was such a weird... First of all, I just want to dispel the notion that I am, like, crushed by this, because people don't seem to understand that
you're a Chicago Bulls fan?
Exactly. Yeah. I like it when the Warriors win. I'm a little disappointed when they lose, but, like, you don't have to worry about me. As far as Sadland goes, it's been weird. It was such a weird combination down the stretch in the last couple games of the finals of abject terror and supreme confidence. Sort of just something I've never quite seen before. And I think that led to an equally weird post-game reaction. Some people are conspiracy theorists. Other people, are wildly overreactive, which is pretty standard fan behavior. But I think people ultimately will be just fine.
Yeah, I'm actually, of the two of us, I'm the Warriors fan.
Yeah. I'm not sure there's much to say besides, well, LeBron. But the other thing to say is...
You did Skip Bayless? No?
Well, that guy. Cleveland, though, is a completely legitimate 2016 NBA champion, just like the Warriors were a completely legitimate 2015 NBA champion. And all I mean is things happened in both cases that were extremely beneficial to the champion. And those things were not always necessarily specific basketball things. I mean, they were related. Last year, the Warriors got some benefit of injury to other teams at critical times. This year, Cavs got a little bit of injury to other teams' benefit. They got a suspension to their benefit. And all of these things are part of the story that was the NBA season. None of them make the championship anything less than completely legitimate, because that is what happens on the way to a championship, is crap. Crap happens. And so the
things
fact
happen,
that different...
Someone won. I agree.
Exactly. That's all I really want to say, is I get very annoyed by the take of, oh, see, the Cavaliers, now that they're full strength, they beat the Warriors, so last year, whatever. It's like, no, that's not how it works.
Who's saying that, though? Is that a thing
Cavs
people are
fans,
saying?
Yes, Cavs fans are saying that. And saying it loudly on Twitter, if nowhere else.
Yeah, but whatever. You know.
No, I know.
People
but
Twitter.
But that is a sign, like, that's an opinion.
Yeah, sure. Yes. But if I want to start thinking about the opinions that some people have, maybe on Twitter... I'm going to be a sad person. I'm going to be depressed about humanity.
You're right, but I do think that's something that's been bandied about and even put
maybe. I don't know. I just have a hard time wrapping my mind around Matthew Dellavedova champion.
Yeah, I mean, I think J.R. Smith champion is maybe the
It's much easier for me to swallow that.
Really?
Honestly. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
I past Kevin Garnett, there's nobody I hate. Sports hate more than Matthew Dellavedova, at least in the NBA.
Oh, because you get up in arms about dirty play.
I do get up in arms about dirty play.
Yeah.
Dellavedova is like the worst kind of dirty, like that.
Oh, I totally disagree with that.
That like he's like that guy in your pickup game that, you know, is taking things just a hair too seriously and fouling you in these kind of unnecessary ways. You know what I mean? Like just annoying dirty.
You're right, but at the same time, I mean, this is the same conversation we have about LeBron off the court. You know, Draymond can call him what he called him in the game, which, by the way, I, to my understanding, was not just the B word that was reported, but was actually the B word he used was just boy, but he placed an F word directly before it. You can call LeBron that. You can call LeBron a bitch. But at the end of the day, his whining and complaining gets results. Draymond got suspended. He gets beneficial foul calls. So at what point, how much bitchery are we okay with if it wins us a title?
Well, look, I mean,
and by the same token, how much annoying, dirty play? Because that guy on the pickup court gets you extra rebounds.
I guess.
And,
yeah, but no one wants to play with him.
You're annoyed, but if he's on your team, he's helping.
Nah, no one wants to play with that guy even. But yeah, look, I mean, I think that you're essentially asking the flopping question, which I don't know, presumably we might get into when we talk soccer a little bit later on.
Oh, boy, yeah.
But, you know, of course, there's an incentive. There's an incentive to flop in all sports, but certainly in basketball. And there's an incentive to bitch.
Politicking.
Yeah, to politic. Yeah, that's all the same animal. All right, we spent probably more time in the NBA Finals at this point than it deserves being a...
True, put it to bed.
A relic of the past. Should we discuss the other big game on Sunday night?
Yeah.
God, I hated this episode of Game of
What?
I'm just kidding. I loved it. It was great.
Oh God, I was gonna say we might have to stop the podcast because I don't know how to talk to you anymore. because you know what? And this is a sad statement on my life, but you know what? I found myself thinking watching this episode is like, well, I hope Derek's happy. There's really no magic here, and there's like a lot of human interaction and battle.
Yep, it was a perfect episode for me.
Yeah.
In that regard. I enjoyed this one. I mean, look, there were certainly, when you start breaking it down in the battle scenes and things, some things that you would say were improbable.
Sure.
But to me, almost in the same, like, and, you know, maybe I just don't watch enough medieval era movies, but seeing the formation, right, the pincher formation that, you know, the Bolton army makes against these guys from that point of view, that's something I haven't seen before and something that was visually striking.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I think, one of the places where the show really excels. I mean, as many medieval battles as we've seen, I don't know that if you've seen one that kind of gives you that almost that Saving Private Ryan viewpoint,
yeah,
of just
like
the
filth and the misery of the whole experience.
Yeah, hand-to-hand combat, guys fighting on top of bodies, and I thought all of that was really well executed.
I totally agree. I loved it. I just, you know, and they had a lot. Expectations were high, and I think it was great. I mean, I literally have no complaints. Like I even though I blatantly should have seen the Sansa turn coming. And by the way, we're gonna have to spoil a little bit of this, I think, just to talk about where things are headed for the series finale. Even though her reaching out to Littlefinger, given what she had said about the battle, given her position and the fact that she clearly sees herself as a leader, although she's not being respected as such by the dudes around, it was a somewhat predictable turn, but I didn't see it coming. And I was thinking to myself, what on earth is going to happen here when the Littlefinger troops ran out and sort of ended the thing?
Oh, you did? Really? See, all right, so this is one of the things. And look, I don't think this is a flaw of the show. We talked about this in the past. I just think it's sort of the nature of the design. But I do feel like, yes, there are certain things now we know are going to happen, you know, because the story sort of needs them to happen. You know, like, you knew Jon Snow was going to walk out of was going to come out of this battle, right. You know, at the very least, you know, and the show was clever, I think, about raising the specter of, you know, would they resurrect him?
Resurrection again.
Yeah. But he was going to be around.
Yes.
And I think, you know, by that same turn, you probably knew that meant Ramsay needed to die, right?
Yeah. Yes. No. So but that's what I mean is, when like the troops had essentially murdered each other and there were like 15 living people left and Ramsay was standing on the hill wondering what he was going to do, but thinking he had won. I did assume Ramsay was not going to win and Jon Snow was going to die, but I did not necessarily see Sansa coming.
I mean, once you saw that, once you saw the literal cavalry coming, you were like, oh, I know how this is going. Yeah. Okay.
But nevertheless, I think, like you said, we're pretty sure Jon Snow is going to be alive, which means we're pretty sure Ramsay's going to be dead. But that doesn't mean we know Sansa is going to be the leader essentially, who turns the battle. And Sansa is going to coldly set Ramsay's dogs upon him, which was one of the most awesome revenge scenes we've had yet.
I was going to say, were you happy with that was the way he went out? Because I've spent a lot of time thinking about,
I love that,
how is Ramsay going to get his one day?
I thought that was great. I mean, the only thing she could have done more was make it last longer.
I was really hoping for some sort of castration, to be honest.
Yeah, but let's just...
about this show? That's where I'm at.
Getting your face eaten off while you're alive is a pretty brutal death.
Yeah, but that was stuff Ramsay did to people he barely cared about, like like his stepmom.
True. You know what I do? You know what I do appreciate though is like that we're not getting into the action movie trope of like, well, we'll just keep him alive and torture him and keep him in a cell for a while, and then before you know it, he's back on the streets.
Yeah, no, that was good, and that wouldn't have been very Game of Thronesy, I feel like, if they'd done that. Did you play the parlor game before, where you're like, who's gonna die tonight? Because I definitely did.
A little bit, and Rickon was definitely the odds-on leader, the poor little guy.
Oh yeah, I was really mad that I didn't think of Rickon. Of course, and as soon as I saw him on screen, I'm like, of course, Rickon's gonna die.
They even kind of said it.
Yeah,
like I think it was Melisandre? Who was it that said?
Sansa, oh, no. I think said Rickon's dead.
Oh right, it was Sansa. Yeah, she's like, no. Rickon's dead. You don't understand. Ramsay's going to kill him no matter what. Forget Rickon's ass. which, by the way, I love hardcore Sansa so much.
Yeah. Yeah, hardcore Sansa's great. I think we'll be seeing a lot more of hardcore Sansa.
Oh, yeah.
I
mean,
story progresses.
I can only assume where it goes from here is essentially a brewing war. We're going to have a war on three fronts, right? We're going to have the Stark plus army, which now probably includes some extra bannermen now that they don't have to be afraid of the Boltons.
Right.
And they're going to be stuck between, essentially, the Lannister army and the White Walker army. So there's two fronts. And then we got Daenerys likely on her way over in a minute. That's going to bring the war to a whole different scenario. And just, I mean, I think, you know, in the way we've talked about that, this sort of as a fantasy story, it's somewhat predictable endpoint.
Well, I mean, it's
like we assume that everybody ends up facing the White Walkers.
I was going to say, yeah,
it's
not a battle on three fronts, right? It's going to be a battle on two fronts. Eventually, it's just going to be man versus White Walker.
Right. We think that, but I'm very interested to see how it gets there, because I don't know that there's any way to make the Lannisters fall in line with the Starks and aim north instead of at the Starks. And then, you know, what state of affairs we're in when Daenerys arrives is fascinating to me.
Well, I think the man sides will all go to – the unsupernatural sides will all go to war. And then in the midst of that chaos, the White Walkers will appear and everyone will be like, oh, we've all got to fight these dudes now. And then, you know, whatever's left will get the throne. That's the way it seems like it's coming out to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the broad strokes of the most predictable ending. But I think if we've learned anything, there are probably some twists and turns getting us there.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, there'll be interesting things along the voyage. I'm curious. Do you read Alan Sepinwall at all?
Not really, no. But I will if you're asking me to.
I'm not necessarily asking you to, although I think he's a really great writer and good on the show. But I did think it was interesting because Alan Sepinwall had my corner on this episode. You know, he wrote a review saying he didn't really like it and just got savaged for it. And
wait,
and
saying so, he didn't really like Witch.
This episode.
Or the previous?
This episode.
Really?
Yeah. And even though I didn't agree with that, obviously I felt some ability to empathize with that position. You know, having the week before not like the episode and everyone thinking I was crazy.
Right.
And it is interesting. I do feel like there is a hive mind. You know what I mean? Like not a hive mind in a way that like, you know, people are brainwashed, but I think people do take it personally if you have criticism of the show. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I also think though, and I haven't read the Sepinwall review obviously, but I feel like it's a little unfair. I don't know if unfair is the right word. Misguided. I don't know. There's something slightly goofy to me about saying, well, it's become too predictable because we're pretty sure the good guys are going to win in the end.
Yeah.
If you hate things where the good guys win in the end, then you're going to have to stop watching everything.
By the way, but that's not my criticism, and that's not Sepinwall's either.
But it does seem to – that is like a broad version of the criticism that I think is most common, which is that the show doesn't surprise us like it used to. And I think part of that is you know the characters better than you used to. You know the world better than you used to. And yes, ultimately, the good guys are probably going to win.
Right. And we're headed towards an end. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Or at least there's going to be an end point where the good guys look like they have a chance to win, you know? So I don't know how fair it is to complain that like, oh, I'm not as surprised as I used to be. That's just kind of the nature of the deal.
I think it's, you know, and look, it's semantics. But I think it's almost a difference between complaining and bemoaning. You know what I mean? Where it's yeah, I don't have a gripe about the show becoming more predictable because, like I said, I don't think there's really anything you could be done about it.
Right.
I just sort of long for the unpredictability. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I'm not sure it's realistic to expect
it. Yeah, I don't expect it.
But I get it.
Yeah, I don't expect it. I just liked when I never knew what was going to happen, where I felt like anything was on the table.
Sure.
And I feel like I've lost that a little bit. And that's, like I said, it's not anybody's fault. It's just the nature of this kind of storytelling.
Yeah, I would agree.
So and I'm all kind of, you know, I'm psyched for obviously the final episode of the season, although my expectations are diminished just knowing the pattern of the show. That usually episode 10 is a bit of a come down from episode 9.
Yeah, it's more of the denouement where 9 is the climactic action.
What are we going to do, you know, in future seasons when there aren't 10 episodes? Are we just going to assume the next to last one is going to be where everything peaks? Or
I have no idea. Yeah. And I think the thing I'm most upset about is a season of less than 10 episodes, because that's just not enough.
Yeah. It feels like sort of like the end of like Breaking Bad where they kind of.
Yeah, or The Sopranos. You know. And I don't like that.
From what I understand, this episode, the runtime on episode 10 is an hour 15. And it does seem like there are a lot of loose ends that still sort of need to be wrapped up in this season. So I do think it's going to be interesting to see how they get to a lot of that.
Yeah, although I have to say, like, rarely do all the loose ends we want get wrapped up in the season finale. Usually several of them are left very much hanging.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done in the Lannister scenario, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we get the trial, and I would not be shocked if we get some ultimate resolution to the High Sparrow situation.
Yeah, I mean, look, Marjorie clearly still has a heel turn in her, right?
That's the worst character development in the history of television.
I mean, she's pretty clearly set all this up, right? So that domino needs to fall. There's a, you know, yeah. Do you think the High Sparrow is the person most likely to die in the next episode?
Yeah, probably. But this one is tricky. This one I could see, because the characters that I am very confident will not die super soon are the Stark kids. So Bran, Jon, Sansa, and Arya.
Mm-hmm.
I feel pretty confident they'll all be alive for the foreseeable future. On the south side, I feel like anybody could get it. Like, I would not be, I would not be
South Side. I love it's like it's Chicago.
Yeah. I would not be shocked, certainly not in the way I would have been if John or Sansa had died, if Cersei died. You know, I don't think it's the most likely outcome. I think she probably wins. But how would you be shocked if Tommen died? I wouldn't.
Not only would I not be shocked, Tommen is going to die. It might not be next episode, but that's going to happen. And I would say almost certainly within the next 5 or 6, like, he's going to die.
I think that's
Tommen is going to die. That feels like a lock to me.
Either Jaime or Cersei dying would not shock me at all. I mean, it'd be a mild surprise. Again, it's not the one I expect the most, but I wouldn't be
Jaime,
shocked.
If you're talking about this next episode, Jaime would be a shock because I feel like he's now – I feel like you may not even see Jaime in this next episode. You know what I mean?
He's like, well, I think he's at the – I think you saw a glimpse of him in the, you know, scenes from
Oh, yeah,
week.
Yeah. But he's – you know what I mean? He's kind of away from all of this.
He's stuck. Yeah, he's stuck with the Freys. But
oh,
yeah,
that's right. You're right. He's in the middle of the Frey thing. But, I don't – he seems safe at least for this episode. It wouldn't shock me if he died at some point in the show. Yeah. Cersei would surprise but not shock me.
Yeah, like happen. I said, so I think it's a little more open. Like, this past episode, we were pretty sure Ramsay was going down, and we were pretty damn sure Rickon was going down. And I actually thought either Davos or Thor, what's his name, Thorgard?
Yeah.
I thought one of them might die as well.
You knew someone from that side that you care about was going to die, and I was sad that it was Yun Yun. The big giant guy.
Yeah.
I really like that guy.
I did too. And didn't we
always
like,
enjoyable.
Was that like the extinction of giants that we just watched?
Maybe. I don't know.
Like, I think because there were like 2 or 3, and I feel like the other 1 or 2 died already. I don't know.
See, like, that is the level of fantasy that I am comfortable with, right? It's like, I can accept that there are giants. Okay. If that's the premise that we have giants in this world, I'm in. I'm fine, and I'm sad when they die. I can accept that there are dragons. You know what I mean? I will allow for fantastical things. At some point, I need some sort of lines
no
and rules
blood
and structure.
Magic, damn it! I will not stand for
no.
Blood
like
magic.
Even some amount of blood magic. I just they're good. I have a point, and we passed that point somewhere.
Yeah. No. I compare this to your superhero fatigue. I think it's very similar.
It is. It is a little bit similar. And
you've had all of those. All of the slots available for fantasy acceptance are full.
Off topic a little bit, but what's your level of anticipation for Suicide Squad?
So I'm not a guy who anticipate. I'm not a comic book guy. So in as much as I anticipate any of these comic book movies, it's as movies and as like entertainment times, pretty pure escapist entertainment times. And in that respect, pretty excited. You know, I'm not going to be in line. I'm not going to go make a point of going the first day or even the first weekend. But it does look good to me, and I do believe I will have a fun time watching it.
Yeah, see, this one is a little war with me. This is because, like, the buzz about Jared Leto is good. I feel like, Batman has been the most, the Batman universe has been the most fruitful in terms of producing good superhero movies.
That's so telling because the Batman universe is the one with the least sort of magical nonsense.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah.
So, I'm definitely interested, battling my superhero fatigue a little bit.
When's the last time Will Smith had like a big meaty role like this?
It's a good question.
Unless you count Concussion, it's been a long time. I'm kind of excited about that.
Koski, tell the truth.
I think I just did. Okay. He hasn't made a movie anyone's excited about in like 5 years.
You're right. That is the truth. That is the truth. Oh man. All right. Should we switch gears? Should we talk a little soccer? You have more Game of Thrones thoughts?
No, I think we can move on. I'm sure we'll get into it again after the season finale. So, let's not belabor the point here. Yeah, let's talk about soccer, if you want to call it that.
All right, so we're recording this the day after the U.S. loses in the Copa America semifinals 4-0. And
by the way, spoiler alert, but also it could have been 25-0 and no closer.
Yeah, I mean,
or no less close, rather.
It's weird, you know what I mean? Because like soccer is a kind of sport where, you know, you could say your team got beat down, and the score of the game may or may not reflect that. You know what I mean?
You can have a beat down at 1 or 2-0.
You could get beat down 2-0, and it could be just as bad as getting beat down 4-0. And in fact, you know, it's almost interesting to me, like, you know, in the U.S., you're still measuring yourself against Mexico a little bit. Mexico also took a beat down the other night. They lost 6-0.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's some, you know, a U.S. tendency to sort of compare those two results and go, did we get beat down as bad as Mexico did? And I almost think we did in a way, even though the scoreline was worse. Now, Mexico quit on that game.
That's right.
So
Mexico quit. So congratulations to the U.S. players for
not
having
quitting.
More emotional mettle than the Mexico side. And that's not – I mean, I'm being a little facetious, but that's not a joke entirely. You know, that's – I think that tells you, you know, they're playing for the coach, which is positive. And they're tough mentally, which is positive. But they also – are on such a different plane for all the alleged progress that this U.S. national men's team has made. We are playing a different game than the truly great teams in the world.
Well,
we're not playing the same sport.
You know, that's the thing that scares me on this game as a referendum on U.S. soccer is that yes. Is Argentina a better side than us? Absolutely. Clearly. Do they have a gear that we don't have? Yes. Almost undoubtedly. But two things can be true. Like, Argentina can be really great and better than us, and we can play terribly. And I think both of those things were true. Like, that was a dreadful U.S. performance, not at all entirely dictated by the quality of the opponent. Now,
okay. Well, I have not watched a ton of U.S. soccer outside or before this game, so I'm prepared to accept that. Here's what I'm not prepared to accept at this point any longer as someone who has some interest in the U.S. soccer team being good. Michael Bradley. I am not prepared to accept any longer.
Well, and that's kind of what I mean. Like, that was I've seen Bradley probably play 80 times in my life. Like, that was definitely one of the two or three worst performances for Michael Bradley that I've seen.
It may have been.
Like, just an all-time terrible performance.
But you know what? I've watched him probably 20 times, and fundamentally, he's not a good enough ball handler to be center mid on a legitimate national team. He's simply not. And last night he also literally could not find a teammate with a pass all night long, which made it worse. And usually he's not that bad at that in my experience. But
I want to give credit to a friend of mine who was a pretty good soccer analyst. And like, within the first 5 minutes of the game, says looks like we've got overwhelmed by the moment. Michael Bradley will be good for 3 to 5 turnovers in the zone in each half, and that proves to be completely prophetic. And I
think that was actually an understatement.
Yeah, and that's he was overwhelmed by the moment. But the problem is that the U.S. can't win and succeed in major tournaments when he doesn't play well. That's the problem.
Honestly, just looking at the roster once, there are things I would do already to get him the hell out of there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that it's about getting him the hell out of there as much as it might be changing his role and the fact that we're so reliant on one player in the midfield to play well. is not a good sign. But
also, if we're going to put someone in that role, there are three other guys I'd rather have in that role. From watching last night.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Who are those three guys?
Well, Beckerman, for one, who is not so much better at possessing the ball, honestly, but can make stuff happen and is not as easily physically dominated as Michael Bradley.
Yeah,
is.
But Beckerman's a physical but defensive oriented midfielder. Like you don't want him quarterbacking your offense, you know.
Would rather have Zusi.
Part of the issue with Bradley is that his role has changed. Klinsmann changes his role a lot. You know, in this tournament, he's been a pinned back deep central midfielder, you know, where they've had him trying to ping passes and free kicks into the box offensively and tracking back deep defensively. And sometimes that's been his role. Sometimes he's been, you know, very forward and playing underneath strikers. Sometimes he's been a traditional central midfielder, you know, paired with Jermaine Jones or another guy. You know, tactically, they move him around a lot. And some of those things, he's better at than other things. And that's – look, I think Klinsmann may get off, you know, the hot seat a little bit in this discussion because people are just looking at the talent gap and going, we don't have a Messi or a Higuain.
That was also obvious that, you know, there's maybe two guys on the U.S. squad who could play for Argentina on their best day.
Sergio Aguero would be the best player in U.S. history by a mile and didn't even get off the bench last night. He didn't come in as a substitute in that game. So,
And by the way, I will say, on a positive note, I think Pulisic, however you say his name, the kid, he has a real good chance to be one of, if not the best player in U.S. history. And, you know, man, credit to Clint Dempsey. That dude works. And he's better on the ball now than he was even during his really high-scoring runs. I'd honestly rather have him in the midfield than Michael Bradley at this point, just because he's strong to the ball and he makes decisive plays with it. And I wish he got more touches in these games. Part of the problem is when he's your striker, he's standing around waiting for the ball a lot, and so much of the U.S.'s forward action is booting it down the sidelines to Zusi or Zardes. And Zardes can do that, which is nice. I'm not sure we've really had a guy that can burn down the edges and get the ball the way he does, but there's very little sustained attack because of that.
Well, and
because we can't control it in the midfield.
Well, sort of. Also, we just had a toothless lineup. I mean, when Chris Wondolowski is up top.
Wando is lovable, but he represents the past of U.S. soccer more than the future.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's made his home in the Bay Area for a long time, and from all accounts, is a genuinely good guy.
He's Brian McBride. You know,
no, he's. I wish he was Brian McBride. He's international Doritos. Like he does. This is to me, Chris Wondolowski is emblematic of the problem that U.S. soccer has. It's not that we can't put out an 11 that are competitive against the better teams in the world. And we've gotten results in competitive tournaments against Spain. You know what I mean? Against we've beaten Germany. We've beaten England and Italy. Like we can play on our best days with any team in the world. But
I don't know if we can play with that team.
I
don't care how well
we can
play.
And we have.
I don't know that we could really play with that team.
I mean, look, look, are we going to beat them? You know, if we play them 10 times, are we going to beat them more than once or twice? No.
The U.S. had one scoring chance last night.
Oh, yeah. No, we didn't get a shot. We didn't get a shot. And I think that they had, I think it was something like 45 passes in Argentina territory, which is pathetic. But again, I wouldn't necessarily put last night's game as a referendum of how we look against the league competition because we played horribly. Like that's not the best of U.S. soccer, and that's part of my point. Is that Chris Wondolowski has played now in the U.S.'s last two most competitive games, you know, from a tournament perspective. And he is simply not an international quality soccer player.
No, he's not.
Has no business being in games that matter. And our level of depth that we need to call in a Chris Wondolowski, that he makes even these teams, that is the issue.
Well, why would they not start Pulisic in that game? I don't care if the kid – you need to catch a spark against the number one team in the world. I don't care if he might make mistakes, if the moment might be a little too big for him. What's the point in having Wondolowski out there?
I agree completely. To me, you send him out there, and the lineup that they had was a signal that they were going to be in a compact shell and try to absorb pressure.
Wondo is the guy that
goes out the window in the third minute when they score.
Yep.
So
because Wondo's a guy you throw up there who you hope gets a lucky bounce and one good shot off.
Yeah, and I'd ask you why. I mean, once you go down 2-0, why leave Wondo out there? Like, why wait till halftime to substitute him?
Especially when he's making plays that specifically reflect his. The fact you just mentioned that he's simply not an international quality soccer player.
Right.
I mean, he made plays all throughout the first half that said, I can't compete on this level, so I'm doing these things.
Right. And he continued to make those plays. Not to mention, you know, the sitter against Belgium that would have put us in the freaking World Cup quarterfinals.
Yeah.
So, I think we've seen enough.
Bad misses of all time.
I think we've seen enough, and this is the problem, is that, you know, once we get past our best, you know, 11 to 13, 14 guys, we can't compete. So, you know, in a game in which we have got three players, you know, on red card, and I understand we have some injuries. We didn't have Altidore available. We didn't have Aaron Johansson available, guys
and
who would have played ahead
the
of Wondolowski.
Would be in there with Dempsey to start the game.
Yeah, I get that. But
I still don't understand why you don't go to the future. Because remember when he started, that was Jurgen's whole thing, is we're not going to waste our time, even in the case where those guys are better today, which I don't think that's true of Wondolowski and Pulisic. Jurgen said early in his tenure, I'm playing for the future, so I'm going to play guys that may one day be world-class players.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, you know, he talks about how, you know, he wants guys who want to compete, and he wants young guys, and we have to push, and we have to go out there and run at these great teams, and then doesn't always back that up with tactics and decisions and favors veterans at weird times. And it's frustrating as a fan of the game to see where we're at right now. And you look at this tournament. You know, if you're using the tournament as a measuring stick, we beat the teams that we should beat at home. Some of them were like quality sides. You know, beating Ecuador is a decent accomplishment. But we also lost to all the teams. We played Colombia, we got drilled, and we played Argentina, we got drilled. We lost to the teams you'd expect us to lose.
With any luck, we'll get Chile in the third place game, and if they rally and actually compete, that's a team you can compete with, I think.
Ooh, first of all, I think Chile will beat Colombia, and I think a Chile Argentina final would be outstanding.
I think either one of those. Is Colombia not the favorite?
No, Colombia is not the favorite. Argentina is the favorite.
No. I mean to win this game.
I think Chile is the favorite. I'll have to, you know what? I'm going to look that up while we're talking. Chile won the last Copa.
But obviously Argentina is the favorite to win the Copa.
And they are, in the ESPN Soccer Power Index, actually Colombia is 8 and Chile is 9. So I would say that's probably a fairly even matchup in Vegas.
In the somewhat meaningless FIFA rankings, Colombia is listed as number 3 and Chile is number 5.
Chile is a small favorite according to these odds that I see.
Despite being ranked lower on two lists, that tells you how much to buy into soccer rankings.
They're plus 150.
One other wait, what?
Plus 150 to win in regulation.
Chile is?
Yeah, now
that means they're the underdog.
No, because the way that soccer works, if you're talking about win in regulation, it's a little different than just flat out winning, and everyone's going to have a plus. You know, they're going to be the lowest plus in that situation.
Gotcha. Well, one other thing to say before we move on from soccer. Lionel Messi is Steph Curry is Adrian Peterson is Barry Bonds, Mike Trout, whoever you want to pick. He's greatness personified. And it's apparent almost every time he touches the ball. And if you have any love for sport and for greatness in general, you got to watch this guy. It's unbelievable.
You know, who was it? I want to say Richard Deitch, I think, had a really good analogy on Twitter that he was trying to think of the best comparable athlete, and he had Wayne Gretzky.
Gretzky's a great one. I think Curry's pretty good because I don't know that Messi rises above everyone in history the way Gretzky did. I think Curry's good because he's the best right now, or, you know, was for 2 years, and he is electric and quick and does things no one else can do.
Well, and, you know, I thought it was a good comparison in that, you know, obviously he's a transcendent scorer, but really a really good distributor as well, yeah.
The pass on the fourth goal was insane. And the second goal, that penalty kick, or not, you know, not PK.
The free kick, yeah.
Free kick. I mean, in a way it's expected, you know, because he's tying his shoes and lining it up and the announcers are like, well, this is trouble. But
I literally said out loud, something bad is about to happen. before he took the kick.
Time, to put it in the 1 foot by 1 foot space in the upper right corner, around the wall, out of reach of the goaltend. I mean, come on.
Like, you know, people say this as like a thing, and I mean it literally. Like, you could not have drawn that kick any better. You know, like,
no, that was
it was perfect. Like, yeah. The arc where he put it, it was completely unsavable. You know, and it had velocity, by the way. It wasn't like just was like a little like looping shot. Like, it was perfect. It was
the pass on the first goal, which was an embarrassing defensive lapse and an embarrassing goalie lapse. That pass was tremendous.
Yeah.
Floating it right over the heads of the defense. Now, how a guy has 6 feet of open space in a radius around him inside of the eight is absurd.
Well, he creates that. I mean, you know, that's
But come on, someone has to have body on that guy, and Brad Guzan got stuck in his boots.
Yeah, no, that look, don't get me wrong, it was horrendous play by the US. I'm not trying to excuse anyone here, but it is one of the gifts of Messi and one of the things that makes him so great, and not a thing that you necessarily get on television is his off the ball movement is really superb. And that is a Steph like thing. Yeah.
You know, that's the thing we talk about with Steph Curry, the gravity of a player like that. Why does Draymond Green get a 4-on-3 run at the rim from the free throw line? Well, it's because you have to double team Steph Curry at 30 feet, you know? And Messi naturally has a gravity to him on the field to where, especially when he's anywhere near the goal, you're leaning towards him. You're afraid of him. And well, so
can you imagine
stuff happens around him?
You're just random Spanish defensive back playing in La Liga. And you have him in the center playing with Neymar and Suarez.
That's like, so terrifying.
I can't even like.
I mean, it's literally ridiculous. The best player in the world with what? Two of the three best strikers in the world.
You're talking about three of the top five or six strikers in the world. And any one of them could beat you individually and you have to deal with all three.
And Messi just does these things in the middle of the field where he dribbles through traffic and delivers these incredible forward progress making passes. He is
a joy to watch.
Again, you can love or hate soccer. If you have any appreciation for greatness, you gotta watch this guy.
So here's my, you know, just to take it back to the you know, the question of kind of where do we go from here.
Where do we go now?
You know what? I think the casual fan who was, you know, finally got a chance to watch some of this tournament with the finals ending and then, you know, saw this transcendent performance, you know, there's a feeling of where's our Messi, or, you know, we need a Messi to, you know, if we're truly going to have, massive growth of soccer in the U.S. for the casual fan. Look, it's clearly growing at a really nice rate, you know, for people who are, you know, sports fans. You know, the game's getting bigger. I don't think there's any denying that. But yes, if you're talking about it, taking hold of the casual imagination that we would need a superstar, and I don't know if I 100% buy that, just because of the nature of the game, and having one great player it's hard to affect an outcome.
I would actually say we probably, if you're talking about for the U.S., you got to win to be popular, I think.
Right.
And I think in terms of winning more regularly, it would be better to raise the floor than the ceiling.
Agreed. Like, I think we need what we need are, you know, is more depth. And look, I mean, you know, as we can talk about how great Argentina is and how talented they are, and they're the number one FIFA ranked squad in the world, and I think number one in the Soccer Power Index.
Yeah, and it's by a lot, too.
They also haven't won a major senior title since 1993.
Yep.
So it doesn't guarantee you a championship. Winning the World Cup is hard. There are only 8 countries, I believe, that have ever done it. So it's, you know, Wales would be a good example of a country that's, you know, has a transcendent player in Gareth Bale, and you can see that's good enough to get them through the group stage. But they're not. That doesn't give you a title. You know, you need a deep squad to win a lot of these major tournaments. And I do think winning would help us in terms of popularity more than just having an amazing player. And amazing players are hard to come by. I mean, you look at Mexico. You know, this whole thing isn't easy. Like, everyone's like, well, if we put all our best athletes in soccer and we had a soccer culture, like Mexico is a really populous country. They've got over 100 million people. They love the game. They've been playing it forever, and they haven't gotten past the quarterfinals of a World Cup. And while they've got some guys who have been starters on major European teams, they've never had a Messi.
Yeah,
in Mexico,
no one's ever had a Messi. But also, yeah. You know, I'm not sure the athlete thing is as true now as it was 10 years ago. Because look, in a soccer combine, you know, measurable athleticism. Don't you think DeAndre Yedlin would be pretty close to Messi, if not even better in some
ways? Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I think he'd be better. Yes. And that's the other thing is like,
so
you know, all
these
guys who want to say like, oh, if our basketball players were – and it's like, well, no. I mean,
would it be great if Russell Westbrook was playing on our soccer team? Yes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean he'd be Messi.
Right, and it doesn't – it's a little bit of a different skill set. Like, yes, athleticism definitely matters. But you need certain kind of skills, and frankly, guys with large feet are at somewhat of a disadvantage in those skills. So,
yeah.
You know, I would think we'd be better off, you know, if all of our, you know, defensive backs, if all of our corners, you know, had gotten into soccer rather than football, than necessarily if all of our basketball players had. Certainly,
well,
anyone over 6'5" is going to have problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's a few guys. I mean, I think, you know, Steph Curry is one that would have
been
a great soccer athlete.
Steph Curry's one, yeah.
Russell Westbrook would have been a center back or you know, a forward back or something like that. But he would be a tremendous soccer player, I think.
You'd have to think his aerial game would be tremendous if he'd run a play.
And then after that, it's the little guys. It's Nate Robinson. It's Earl Boykins.
Yeah.
Guys like that would have made – with the quickness and the small motor skills and also tremendous athleticism, guys like that would have been incredible soccer players. But again, Clint Dempsey's a pretty great athlete. Jozy Altidore's a pretty great athlete. DeAndre Yedlin's a phenomenal athlete. So we're starting to see some of our elite athletes in soccer, but we just don't – And it's hard for me to identify because I'm sure DeAndre Yedlin's been playing soccer since he was a tiny, tiny little boy, tinier than he is now.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not Messi, so some of it's just luck.
So yes, look, some of it is just luck. I think a lot of it is nurture. You know what I mean? Like, Argentina has a culture.
Yeah, it's
you know,
cultural
where
nurture.
You
it's
can,
not
yeah.
the instruction of one student or one player. It's the overall culture of the way the game is played.
Right, where you have the opportunity to play improvisational soccer and whatever. Right. I think there's a common thing when someone who doesn't watch, and I don't mean this in a snobby way. I just mean people who don't have a ton of handle on the game. You know, it's the Tony Kornheiser thing, and I love Tony, as some of you may know.
Yes.
Where they, they look at the game and they go, well, we have 300 million people and, you know, this nation is tiny and they have, you know, we should be beating them.
That's dumb.
And it's dumb. I mean, if you look at the top 10 nations in the world in terms of population, most of them are not good at soccer at all. Only one of them has won a World Cup, and that's Brazil.
And just in general, that's an absurd proposition about sports, generally speaking. Like, Do we rant about country size when Jamaicans win the sprinting titles?
Yeah.
No.
Like, having a lot of potential athletes does not mean that you will be good at soccer. It just doesn't.
Or at anything.
Yeah. You know, otherwise China would be awesome. You know what I mean? So
at everything.
Yeah. If you look at a list of world population and start picking out the good soccer countries, you're going to find yourself going pretty far down.
Yeah. Belgium, not a particularly large country.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're just raw population, Italy is not, it's 23rd, So it doesn't have a ton to do with that. It has a lot to do with growing up, playing around people who are playing the game and playing the game at a really interesting improvisational kind of level,
I'm
looking at Spain. Spain is 30th in the world in population. Argentina is 31st.
Here's a highfalutin analogy for you. It's a little bit like jazz music, in that someone could have a good ear for jazz and really love jazz and practice and practice and practice and learn everything about it and have all the principles and theory in their brain. And if they grow up not playing with any other great jazz players, they're not going to be a great jazz player.
Yep. And, I think that works. That analogy works on the level of an individual and the nature and the nurture coming up. And I think it also works once you're older and in a national team system, whether it's at the senior team or the under 23s or the under 17s. You can see right now in these tournaments, at least at the senior level, that there's a real gap between the quality of play in North America, CONCACAF, whether it's us or Mexico or whoever, Costa Rica,
and South America.
And also, if you're watching the Euros, you can see that gap exists over there too. And those teams in South America and Europe are playing each other all the time and used to facing down that kind of competition.
Almost all of their players are in those leagues in Europe that are the elite leagues.
Right. We've now got ourselves in a situation where our national team players can make more money here because they have a marketability factor that they're not going to have playing in England or Spain or Italy. And so there's a financial incentive for them to play here. And I do think that ultimately is going to have a tough effect on this national team. And, you look at a guy like Pasilic, who's 17 and playing for Dortmund, is going to play Champions League football next year, with one of the best teams in the Bundesliga. If he does continue to fulfill his potential and becomes an excellent player, there's going to be a financial tug for him to come back to the U.S. at some point as maybe our most marketable. And it'll be interesting to see whether, if he has the ability to stay up at that level, whether he can chooses to continue to try to push himself against the world's elite or if he wants to come home and be at home and make cash. And I can't blame anyone for choosing either.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, that's probably as much soccer talk as I think we'll ever do, I'm going to guess, right?
Well, let's see what happens with the Olympics.
Well, we may get into the women in the Olympics, and we may want to talk Euros at some point as that tournament progresses, because that's been a really exciting, fascinating tournament as well. I'm super excited about how much soccer has been available to me this summer.
It's been a good summer for soccer.
Do you got homework that you want to hand out to anybody before? Oh, you know what? You know what? I do. We should at least mention
OJ.
OJ. Yeah.
For a true life story that was just dramatized in, what, a 10-episode miniseries that I loved?
Yeah, that what we said was probably the best show on television this year.
Yeah. Well, this 6-5-part documentary series may actually have been number one to that number two, because this thing was so good. It usually takes me a month to talk myself into watching a one-hour documentary film. And by the time I was 15 minutes into the first hour and a half episode of this thing, I knew I was watching at least 3 episodes the very night I began watching it. It was, and I ended up watching 4 till about 4 in the morning.
Wow.
It was, oh my God. It's so interesting, and it's so dramatic, and they did such a good job of – so here's the thing. My short way of describing it has been this. When I saw the title, O.J. Made in America, besides my slight O.J. fatigue, which I wouldn't call it really fatigue, but just the thought that haven't I had enough O.J., my other thought was, the hell is that supposed to mean, Made in America? Like, what are they saying? And when you watch it, it's so immediately apparent what they're saying, which is very simply, from every side, look at this OJ situation in every way. His fame, the way he came up to prominence, the way he was celebrated, his relationship with white America and black America, his ultimate empowerment is the wrong word to use, but the fact that he was given an entitlement by our society, that he felt he could do all sorts of crazy stuff and get away with it. The way the murder happened, the way the aftermath, everything about this story truly could not have happened anywhere but America, and probably could not have happened at any time but the specific timeline that OJ grew up and lived in. And the way they put it into context with civil rights and with sort of America's relationship to fame and notoriety, it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, the context of it is so important, and it's the kind of thing that if you didn't live through it, you have no idea. And if you did live through it, yeah, when it was long enough ago that some of that may have been lost to time, just to see it again.
Or you were young enough that it didn't really resonate in that way. Yeah, you know?
I mean, you summed it up really well, and I think it's so deftly touched on each of those points. And you know, it was a perfect storm of a story in the way that it intersected race and fame and the justice system in America, and said as much about our biases as people as it did about the, you know, the participants in the case. Just a fascinating and deeply interesting portrait of the whole situation. And I was so hooked. I watched it basically over 2 nights. That when it ended, I actually went back and started watching the first one again. Just because I wanted to see some of the early San Francisco days and some of that stuff. But it was so wholly engrossing about a story that, you know, now I had already been over the beats of once. And there's so many just transcendent quotes and interesting people, and you see the, you know, the very real and painful emotions of these folks playing out over time. It was so well done, and I can only imagine how long it must have taken them just to gather some of that footage.
My God. And I also thought they made such good choices with the sort of main storytellers of the film, whatever you want to call it, of the miniseries. The guys they chose, whether it was OJ's friends, I thought seeing Marcia Clark talk about the trial, you know, because she clearly hasn't totally gotten over it, and because she, much as she was portrayed in the miniseries, she's not at all shy about talking about how massive a miscarriage of justice she believes happened, and sort of how it happened, which essentially is Lance Ito is a fame-mongering doofus. It was so well done. And I really thought the insight you got from the people who knew OJ as a kid was tremendous.
Yeah. And I you know, the other thing I thought it did, maybe better than any of the other OJ things, is I thought it really humanized Nicole Brown.
Yeah, no question.
In a way that maybe some of the other aspects of coverage hadn't looked at. And look, there were some people that you would like to see that, you know, obviously didn't participate. Christopher Darden, being a big one.
I'm assuming, I don't know if you looked into this or read about this. I'm assuming he still didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I don't blame him. And
no, neither do I.
The documentary I did not think was overly kind to him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the guys.
The show was much better to his point of view, I think, than maybe the documentary was.
Yeah, but the guy got – what happened to him in that trial was unfair and a shame, and also he brought it on himself in large part, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, both those things can be true. It could have been unfair, and he could have made some mistakes.
It's really tough, and that is one of the – that's he is one of the many people in this story that you feel heartbroken for. And I although they were not necessarily kind to him in the documentary, I do think that was apparent that, like, this is a guy who was doing what he thought was right and tried to do his best and deserves some sympathy.
Yeah, for sure. And also I thought, not necessarily speaking of sympathy, but I did think it was interesting that they really got a lot of participation from, some people who didn't come out looking good. In this whole thing, most notably, Mark Furman.
Yep.
But I thought Van Adder, the cop who clearly made some mistakes, like they got some good stuff from him.
I thought he made himself look worse.
He did.
I mean, that guy.
But I don't necessarily mean that he, what he said was good, but he was readily available to talk.
I couldn't believe he was willing to say some of that stuff.
Yeah.
He sounded like he'd make the same mistakes again. Listening to that guy talk was like, are you flipping serious right now?
Yeah.
You're actually complaining about these little side things that happen when it's obvious that you made huge mistakes.
Yeah.
That was fascinating. And honestly, that reflects to me one of the salient, hopefully, lessons from this whole thing is that, like, a huge – look, plenty of cops out there do a really difficult job really well. But there's way too many who have a terrible attitude about their own occupation.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things I think that you're really reminded of when you watch this, because – the general perception, and I think it's increased over time, right, is that, the jury just got it wrong. I think the jury talks about that a little bit.
And I think nothing is more clear from this wealth of OJ stuff we've watched this year than that the jury did their job exactly right.
Well, I don't know about that. There's that one juror, the older skinny lady with the glasses.
Well, she didn't articulate it very well.
she said some things that I found to be terrifying.
She just wanted to go home, and that's bad.
She did say that. There was a few other things too, like that. Basically, we got revenge for Rodney King, and
that's fine. Some other stuff. Let me ask you this.
But here is my
prosecution prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Here is my point: is that the documentary sets up. If you just think, they got it wrong, the documentary certainly makes the case how someone could be convinced that there was a potential police cover up here. That the case for a police cover up was better than it had any right to be, and that was made available because of so much gross negligence and incompetence in the way that the investigation was handled.
I mean, here's my position on this case, and part of this I think is there's an element of who really cares. The guy's in jail anyway now, but I think this is something that's important to remember. The American justice system, such as it is designed, requires competent prosecution. And that did not happen here. This was incompetently prosecuted. And when a case is incompetently prosecuted, you can cross your fingers and hope that the jury cares about truth and sees the truth. But by our laws, I can absolutely see a reasonable doubt created, and I can absolutely understand a jury.
But isn't some of that, when you say incompetently prosecuted, isn't some of it, it's like the NBA Finals in that the referees, you know, in some way control the environment for what is going to be allowed. And if you're going to allow, you know, players to be really physical, movement off the ball, then that's going to have a certain effect on the series. And I feel like, you know, Judge Ito's allowance of race to become an issue in the trial, and I'm not saying whether that allowance is right or wrong or should or shouldn't have happened, certainly changed the circumstances on the ground for in a way that did not help the prosecution.
Judge Ito, that's true. Judge Ito assisted in the incompetent prosecution. However, it wouldn't have been an issue at all if the cops had followed procedures even a little bit.
I guess. I mean, let's say the cops had followed procedures perfectly, but those Furman tapes came out. Don't you think the prosecution would have still had an uphill battle just based on people thinking Furman was a racist?
Maybe, but when you have Furman, first of all, he is a racist. It's not just people
Sorry. People understanding that Furman is a racist.
Right. People do you realizing
think he, but I mean,
Furman,
look, yes, of course he was a racist, but do you think he planted evidence? I don't think he planted evidence.
I'm 80% sure he didn't.
I mean, it goes right back to he would have to, in the moment,
maybe I'm 90% sure he didn't.
That OJ didn't have an alibi.
Yeah, he almost definitely
didn't. He couldn't possibly know that, right?
Well, except that when you're the kind of cop that says the sort of things that he says, why isn't it possible that he did this without even considering the fact that he could get caught up with OJ having an
alibi?
Like, the guy's
just doesn't,
no genius.
It doesn't seem likely to me.
No, it doesn't. I agree. It doesn't seem likely at all.
I'm not saying it's 100% impossible he didn't plant evidence, but I'm fairly certain of it.
I mean, again, am I 85% sure, 90% sure? That's 10%. That's one of every 10 times on the other side.
Yeah, see, I'm higher than that.
And you're supposed to acquit if it's 0.1% on the other side.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that's how the justice system works. Again, we can cross our fingers and hope that a jury sees through some of the shenanigans, but
I would argue the jury should have never heard those tapes if they weren't factually relevant to the case.
Okay.
That's part of the issue.
Okay,
right?
But then should the people at the crime scene have worn gloves?
Yes.
Should the cops have
I'm not saying that the investigation wasn't incompetent, and it was. By the way, that's not necessarily that's not the prosecution's fault, by the way. Like, that's the evidence they're handed.
When I say it was not competently prosecuted, that involves the police behavior as well.
Going back to the initial OJ interview is so botched. And that's something that's in both the television show and the documentary.
And that's another thing that the friggin' cop defended.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I mean,
weird.
They didn't ask him anything.
They did, like, he didn't pin down a timeline. Like, it was crazy.
They did not do their jobs, is the simple fact of it. And when people and look, the police are part of the prosecution. And when they utterly fail to do their jobs, it's not that crazy that you fail to convict the guy.
Yeah, none of this documentary is a good look for the LAPD, that's for sure. So,
no, it is not.
We've gone through a lot of this now, but I'll tell you what. You know, because yes, you probably do know some of the beats of the story. You know, if you've seen the OJ television show, you probably know even more of the beats of the story. It's still worth watching. You will still be grossly entertained. That's a highest recommendation for me. It's a lot of time, but it's totally worth it.
It flies by. I mean, I'm not a big documentary guy, but this is some of the best documentary filmmaking I've ever seen.
Yeah, really good stuff. Good, nice job, ESPN.
Yeah. Give them credit when they deserve it.
All right. Anything else you feel like people really need to see this week?
Oh, man. I'm just I'm trying to get through the NBA draft and then, take a bunch of summer vacation during baseball. That's all I'm focused on right now.
All right. Well, you enjoy that. I'm going to, revel in the rest of this Copa. And
yeah, I'm going to watch on Saturday in the third place game, and hopefully what I see is not as horrifying as what I saw last.
Yeah, and look, the third place game will be tough to judge because you will likely – it's very possible you won't be getting maximum effort from your opponent in that game.
That's fine, but, you know, there's something to be said for just stringing a couple passes together.
There is that. I mean, look, you'd always like to see us play well, but the problem is we just don't play enough games where the stakes are really high. And, you know, it's great to play friendlies against the best teams in the world, but you need to be in competition against them. And you know, last night you saw what an elite team looks like at a focused level. And how much work we need to do to get to that. And we're only going to do that if we see that on a more regular basis.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah. All right. I think we can wrap it up from here, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.